Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Over the past 6 years on our podcast, we've covered a lot of topics, from cowboy churches to quantum physics. But finally, after 307 crescent fresh episodes, we get to the one great question that you've all been wanting an answer for. What is the meaning of life? To assist with our explanation, we go off, of all places, to Central Texas and visit with today's guest, Paul Froese, a professor of sociology at Baylor University and a research fellow at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the fine sponsors of our podcast, and the place, if there ever was to be one, to find the meaning of life. Professor Froese is a prolific author of articles and books on a wide range of topics spanning the globe. His authored books include The Plot to Kill God, Findings from the Soviet Experiment in Secularization, America's Four Gods, What We Say About God and What That Says About Us, co-authored with Chris Bader, who has also been on our podcast before and will be coming up again soon. And then Paul has written most recently, On Purpose, How We Create the Meaning of Life, released last year from Oxford University Press, but still a great contemporary read, because hey, when does the meaning of life ever go out of style? That's what I want to know. Links to this book, Paul's previous appearance on our show, and other fun stuff can be found on our website and our Facebook page. And one last thing, I should note that Paul received all his foundational sociological training from the good folks up here at the University of Washington. Go Dogs! Paul.
Thanks, Tony.
Hey, Paul, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm a dog at heart, and I very fondly remember that foundational training. And right now I'm very jealous of you with your weather because I'm sitting in about 98 degrees.
Oh, and it is downpouring here in about 40 degrees of fog. So, always greener on the other side, I think. So, and also when I said go dogs, that was supposed to be a cue to Rocky Barkington, our podcast mascot, who's lying over there on the leather couch in our studio. And he's just like, he doesn't want to get up. He's a lazy blue tick hound, I guess. So there you have it. Anyways, hey. A book on the meaning of life, like, wow, you're not even 50 years old yet, but here you are writing the magnum opus that every theologian and academic dreams are writing. You solved that whole why are we here question once and for all. So congratulations on that.
Well, don't congratulate me too soon. I feel that I probably haven't answered that question, although I've kind of dug into it, hopefully deeper. One thing I did realize in doing some initial radio shows about the book is, you know, I don't have like the five steps to purpose or that key variable that shows you how to find your purpose in life. So in that sense, I don't have that simple solution. And in fact, you know, when I was working on this book, one of the things that dogged me over and over was just how confusing this question is. So to create some clarity for myself and hopefully for the reader, I ended up trying to structure the book around really just five questions, seven questions in which I could have a conversation with the reader. And if you like, I'll just kind of go through those seven questions.
Yeah, actually, hold back on those questions a minute. Sure. I want to ask what motivated this book to begin with. Give us the history of this idea because, you know, when we left off at the University of Washington and we sent you on your merry way down to Texas, you were reading or writing about Soviet secularism and, you know, what happened in between here that you all of a sudden picked up this meaning of life stuff?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting to me is that initially what I was going to do is I was thinking of writing a book about ideology, you know, kind of big big scale belief systems. And in preparing for that book, I was reading all kinds of literature on ideology that just felt impenetrable. And it got me thinking, it's like, well, how is ideology kind of lived at the individual level? And as I thought more about it, I thought, well, maybe people don't think in terms of, well, this is my political worldview or this is my religious worldview, but rather they think in terms of, well, what is my purpose in life? And so perhaps they could answer that question to themselves and to researchers, and it would tell us something maybe deeper about their entire worldview. So that was one of the motivations, is to really write a book about ideology, but then finding that maybe ideology for the average person comes down to what their purpose in life is. Mm-hmm. And then there was a second motivation, I think, and not to sound pretentious, but it was literary. I was really trying with this book to develop my own writing voice. And one of the things I wanted to do very consciously was to blend methods, so to use survey data, qualitative data, examples from literature, blending in reviews of work in psychology and history and political science, and do that all in kind of a friendly and hopefully intelligent and engaging way. So I think that was another deep motivation for me.
Yeah, and that comes off very clear in this book, too, because you mentioned that the readings on ideology are impenetrable. This book is anything but that. It's a really fun and easy book to read, but still it's intellectually challenging, right? That's the sweet spot that I think that every academic wants to hit, because you can say the smart things that you want to, but reach a wider audience. And I mean, you cover everything from punk rock bands to Buddha and everything. So it's all in there.
Oh, cool. Thank you. And I appreciate, I could tell from some notes you sent me earlier that you really read the book deeply. And so I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And we'll talk about it deeply. But before we dig deep into the book, there's this thing about the cover. And I have a thing about book covers. And I know most people say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but marketing departments put a lot of effort into covers because that's the first thing you see. And you have a very clever one. In fact, it has a little bit of a play on words. The title is On Purpose, and there's a little bit of shading on some of those letters. And then there's also a picture of an eye and a closed eye. Tell us a little bit of story about the book, the secret hidden shaded word meaning and all that stuff.
Okay, yeah, I'll try my best. I always like the cover of your books. I think your last book was a photo you took.
So. Yeah, both books have photos that I took. Yeah, so
nice, because one of the things that happened to me was in The Plot to Kill God, or no, I'm sorry, in America's Four Gods, I hated the cover, and so one of the things I was really interested in is having some say in what this cover looked like, and luckily they let me have some say. And the first thing I really wanted, just for personal reasons, was a blue cover. I just love blue colors. I think they're calming and hopefully inviting. But then you bring up this kind of really cool design, which was done by Lisa Forrest at Oxford. And she had this very clever idea to, in the title On Purpose, to bring out the letters O-U-R, which spells our, and so it kind of taps into the sociological meaning of the book in that our purpose, our personal individual purpose, is always tied to community. So it's always tied to something collective, something greater than ourselves.
Yeah, and that book, that comes across too, because I've read it a few times. I was going to say on our purpose, but it's on purpose, but the our is almost subliminal there.
Yeah, totally. And then the eyeballs, I kind of suggested the eye just, you know, because when you think about purpose, it's kind of, you know, looking out in the world and trying to figure out what your meaning in life is. But then the closed eye to me, so the open eye is looking outward, and the closed eye to me means kind of looking inward. And I felt that theme was in the book, is that you look inside of yourself, but maybe what you find inside is stuff that's around you.
Okay. I didn't pick that up on the closed eye. I don't know.
Okay. Do you have a theory?
I no, I just, I, it was, it, for me, it kind of, at first I look at it, it looks kind of like an Egyptian hieroglyphic. And then, you know, I thought, well, you're looking for the Buddha inner eye meaning. And then when I started looking at the second part, I didn't know it was a closed eye at first. I thought it was like one of those Darwin stickers that you have on the back of a car with the little feet and things like that. And I'm like, and then I figured, oh, it's a closed eye. So I guess, I don't know what I thought. That's why I asked you.
You know, I like that. You know, I've thought about that too, and the idea that maybe there's something evolutionary going on. Mm-hmm. Like you have this kind of creature, and then it evolves into an open eye that you're somehow enlightened or you're finding something.
Well, that could be. So let's dig into this. And you said you had seven questions that
seven
the book
questions.
Asks. I want you to go through those, and then also I want to spend a little bit of time defining purpose, because that's a big word in the book. So go ahead and take either of those, definition of purpose or your five or seven questions.
Yeah, I think I'll start with the seven questions. The again, what I realize is a very big topic, and I could take it in a million different ways. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to conceptualize this as a conversation with the reader where we're kind of dealing together with questions that we might ask ourselves. And so really the seven chapters start with a question to the reader. And so the first one is, what is your purpose? And that I just kind of go through and discuss about maybe popular answers to that question, what people generally say when they're asked that question. The second chapter is, does your purpose make you happy? And here I was kind of delving into this idea of, well, is having a purpose in life different than just wanting to be happy? And I kind of make the argument they are distinct things. Chapter three is the question of, do you lack a purpose? And here I look more at kind of history and how my argument there is that modernization really created this idea that purpose is a choice. And with choice, there's the possibility that you might not find the proper option. And so therefore, your life could feel meaningless. Then the next chapter is purpose within you? And here I'm really kind of dealing with the self, you know, contemporary self-help industry with this idea that all you have to really do is look inward and purpose will reveal itself to you. The fifth chapter is your purpose true, with a capital T? And in this chapter, I'm kind of dealing with mainly religions, where you have this idea that each individual has some sort of immutable purpose that might have been planted in them at birth. And then the sixth chapter is, do you have any time to really ponder this question? I really like this chapter because it deals with the fact that we're all so busy these days that maybe we don't have the time to philosophically reflect on what we're doing. And then finally, the last chapter, I ask, well, are you confused? And there I'm dealing with this idea that, well, meanings constantly change. And so the idea of purpose, the idea of life are kind of slippery concepts that you can't hold down. So I end with this idea that, well, maybe you should be confused, and that maybe there is no clear solution to this question. Rather, I was intending the book to be hopefully an intelligent interchange with the reader. So I hoped the reader then starts to maybe think with me on these issues. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Tony, actually, I'll ask you, did you ponder the question, the meaning of your life as you read the book?
I did a little bit. And the chapter that you liked a lot, too, the one on time, I found to be the most interesting, because you tend to think about it in life phases and the cycles, you know, having kids. And, you know, now we're starting to get close to being empty nesters. And, you know, what do you do? And I just finished a major goal and life achievement. And so I'm like, yeah, now what do I do now? And that kind of thing. So that I did that in the book. It reads like it is, quote unquote, a self-help book, and reads kind of has the vibe of Rick Warren's Purpose-Driven Life, where you have, mm-hmm. you know, distinct chapters walking you through a pathway. But it's still very sociological. In fact, it's not really a self-help book. It's saying here, all the self-help books are trying to do this, and here's the sociology behind it, which I think is really cool. So it really hits, like I said before, that sweet spot of trying to find stuff. I have to admit, though, at the end, you say, are you confused? And, you know, do you really have a purpose? Here, I was going to get you to answer definitively what the purpose of life is. And I was going to end the podcast on that big thing, but now we're just going to have more people on the show until we can figure that out, including one of your former collaborators, Chris Bader. So, and he's always good at telling us what the meaning of life is all about.
What the real answer is.
Exactly. He's good with that kind of stuff. And folks, he'll be coming up in a couple of weeks talking about the paranormal. So you tune in for that.
Oh, cool.
It is really interesting to think about this, and it gets you thinking about what is purpose. And that's a tough, squishy thing to look for. As you mentioned, you know, people think, well, it's happiness. That's kind of the easy answer, but nah, not necessarily that case. How do you define purpose as a sociologist writing this book?
Yeah. The short answer is I tried to say, well, purpose is kind of the meaning you give to experience. It's kind of the answer to the question of why. So, for instance, you know, why do you have children or why do you watch TV? People have conceptual answers to these questions. And for me, that's their answer to the question of purpose. They're telling me why something is important or significant. And so in particular, the question of what's the purpose of life, I read that as somebody saying, this is why I'm significant, this is why I matter in the world. So that to me is what purpose means. Now, one of the things though, is I'm looking for, you know, why people come, you know, how do people come to certain answers to that question? And one quote I have in the book is from David Mitchell, and he's got this line that says, who and what are more important than why? And here I've just said, well, purpose is really the answer to the question of why. But one of my themes throughout the book is the way people answer the question of why, in other words, why are they significant, have to do with who and what is around them. So it really comes back to social context, and that we're nested in these kinds of systems of meaning that at the largest kind of circle is history and culture. And then as you kind of zone in, you start to get into your own community, and then you can kind of zone in and the who and what around you are family members and colleagues and friends. And then in the middle is you. And so the how you answer the question of why am I significant has to reference those who's and what's that are around you.
Yeah, you spend some time going through lots of different books, self-help books, but other things where people are looking for meaning. I mean, you're a sociologist, religion, so you have some familiarity with all the great religious texts of history. But you know, also talk about John Coltrane and Tony Robbins and all that kind of stuff, right? And even there's a fictional football team that you, I think it's Friday Night Lights, that you must have been watching one night, and they're chanting, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. And all of a sudden that works its way into the book. So you're finding this in quote unquote non-academic sources, and you find that there's some kind of common things that everybody kind of coalesces around.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think in the first chapter, there's kind of, hopefully there are layers here. And so the first chapter I was really getting at, well, just in very popular culture, how do people talk and think about purpose? And I came up with, you know, I'm sure there are more, but for me, I came up with three things that I found repeatedly. And this pervaded both kind of religious and self-help approaches to the idea of what the meaning of life is. And the first one I said is that there's this idea that somehow deeply embedded in you, that it's you kind of have to search yourself to find it. And that's a very modern thing, right? This idea of self-discovery, that somehow one of our purposes in life is to discover ourselves. And so we work to discover this kind of true self. And once we discover it, then everything will be revealed. And that's related to the second assumption I argue is out there, and that is once you find this true self, it will transform you into the best possible person you can be. And this is true of both self-help and religions, right? It's like you know, as soon as you find Christ within you, now you can be the best Christian you can be. Or as Tony Robbins, you know, as soon as you find your inner giant, then you can change your world. So it has this kind of transformative quality to it. And then finally, it's going to be great what you find. You know, in kind of a Trumpian language, it's going to be huge and you're going to love it. That once you find this true self, you will ultimately be very happy with it. You know, there tends not to be in popular culture this idea of, oh, well, once you find your true self, you're going to find that you're a real evil jerk.
you know, yeah, it's going to be good.
It's always something good to be found. Yeah. So I found that those three assumptions are pervasive. And then I just try to look at those assumptions sociologically and see, you know, to what extent, well, you know, what do they mean and, you know, do they have some sort of validity to them?
Yeah, there's one other aspect, too. You mentioned those three things that you find commonly, but another thing you just found along the way that's not necessarily explicit in a lot of the Tony Robbins sources or other things that they might talk about is that the search oftentimes requires community. So even though it's a search of personal enlightenment, there's a lot of community around it.
Yes, yes. Well, and I think, or at least the way I think of this book is that is an underlying message or motif throughout. Mm-hmm. Is that it always kind of comes back to community. Is that if you feel significant within a community, then you're going to feel like you have some sort of purpose in life. It's the people who are isolated or alone or feel degraded by their community that will be the ones who don't feel like they have a purpose. And what I thought was interesting is, again, now I'm just talking about more of the popular literature in self-help and maybe religious self-help, is they tend not to talk too much about community.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to be kind of a very individualistic pursuit, is that you're discovering yourself almost on your own. You might have some tips from a guru or a pastor, but it's really done almost in isolation. And of course, I think that's wrong, mm-hmm. right? It requires community always.
Yeah. Yeah, it's those big, huge Tony Robbins rallies is you want to find your inner self, but you're doing that with 5,000 people in the audience, right? You know, it's set in this bigger context of being part of this community. I think that's really important. And speaking of that, I mean, there's one of the things that you do, and if you've done throughout your career, is that you're a good demographic sociologist. You look at the data to find out what people are thinking about this, and you spend some time early on in the book talking about the survey evidence on what people think of as meaning and how it breaks down, who has meaning, what categories of people have meaning or don't have meaning. Give us a flavor for what the demographics of meaning or search for purpose look like.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. Well, I try to do both, right? I try to have data here and try to interpret the data, but then I'm also almost simultaneously saying the data can't tell us everything. And one of the reasons the data can't tell us everything is because the idea of purpose is so abstract that it doesn't really kind of come out in survey data. So for instance, you know, this would come as no surprise. People who say they're very religious are much more likely to say they know their purpose in life and that their purpose is part of a larger plan. So clearly religion maps onto this perfectly because that's not surprising because religious communities have distinct answers to these questions. So we would expect somebody embedded in a religious community to be like, oh yeah, I know my purpose and that is to serve God. And so then we can also look at other things. It's like, well, does being tied to other communities, let's say not necessarily a religious community, also do this? And I think I've found that too. So for instance, if you're a parent, you're more likely to say you have a purpose. So you have in the family unit a kind of a community that you have obligations to, that would give you a sense of purpose in that way. Also, married people are more likely to say they have purpose. So these kinds of things, I think, relate back to this idea of community that you brought up earlier, is that if you're attached to others and it's a positive attachment, you're going to be more likely to say you have purpose. And that's clearly the case with religious communities, but this can also quite easily happen for secular people too.
Yeah. One of the other things you do, and I have to echo some of your concerns about what the data can tell you, because I know there's a trend nowadays that, you know, if we can measure it with a survey evidence, it's a realistic fact, but it has all these problems of what we're actually measuring and can you actually measure some of these things. But you do rely upon, I think, Pew data, I think some Gallup data, might be some World Surveys data. And you find, you know, the stuff that makes top line news stories, the happiest country in the world is, and you do the cross-national stuff, which I think is kind of fun, and you spend a little bit of time, and I got to have you talk about this because I think this is kind of interesting, the Netherlands. The Netherlands is like filled with happy people who have no purpose, which is like one of the most bizarre findings in the entire book. So what the hell is wrong with the Netherlands?
I don't know. I think one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, the happiness variable and the purpose variable they tend to be correlated, but they are distinct. So they don't always have to be. So an example of that would be on the other end of the spectrum, not the Netherlands. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people who live in very kind of either war-torn or very conflict-ridden societies that are living in deep poverty, who are going to tell you that they're not happy in the least, but they lead very purposeful lives. And that to me really tells us that, okay, this is a distinct thing. Because you can imagine that, you know, some tragedy occurs in your life, you know, a death of a loved one, loss of a job, something like this. And for some people, that, okay, that might make you very unhappy, but it can be kind of give you a purpose. Oh, I have to do this, or I'm called to do something else in order to grapple with the hardships that are given me. And so I think that that's seen in this cross-national data, where you have people who live in kind of terrible social circumstances in around the world who all say we're very purposeful. Now, that's probably in many cases tied to religion, because you also have a lot of religious believers and religious communities in these cultures. But I think it's also tied to hardship. Now, we go on the other end of the spectrum to the Netherlands, and here you have the very modern society, of secular society, and I think what's happening there is people are saying, yeah, I'm happy and I'm doing what I want to do. And you ask them, well, what's your purpose in life? And they're like, well, I don't know. You know, I'm not really thinking about this. Now, I don't know what that means ultimately. It clearly doesn't mean that they're unhappy, but it certainly means that they don't have a clear answer for why they're here or what they should be doing. And so I think probably part of that has to do with living in a secular culture, also a modern culture where maybe you're not expected to have an answer to that question.
Yeah, and that brings up another thing that is woven throughout your book, and you spend some time on this too, is you talk about the antithesis of purpose, and that's nihilism. And I love the discussion that you have in certain parts of the book, and it really is kind of woven throughout the whole thing. But you bring up Turgenev, who's actually one of the I'm so surprised you brought that up, because I think it's the only fiction book I like was by Turgenev's Fathers and Sons. And there it's in your book. I'm like, oh, I actually like that. I've read that a couple times. And then right next to it, I think in the next sentence, you talk about King Missile, a punk rock band from the 80s or 90s or something like that. Yeah. And I mean, so really interesting. What are your thoughts here on the antithesis of purpose?
Well, the thing is, I was kind of saying, look, for centuries even, there's been this fear that there's going to be a rise of meaninglessness, a kind of a nihilism is going to overtake us. And on some level, that's a real fear, especially in America today. When you think about just the political discourse going on right now, of people seem very upset and disillusioned and distrustful of institutions. And so to me, these are all markers of potential nihilism, potential belief in meaninglessness. So I think that's a very real fear. But of course, my point is that this fear crops up over and over again. But what saves us, I think, ultimately, is humans will always have communities. They're always going to form communities. And in doing so, they're going to find new purposes, even if the old ones don't seem to be applicable anymore. So we might, you know, kind of in a Durkheimian sense, we're going to lose old sacred totems, but we're going to construct new ones always, so that I don't see a large society or even, you know, falling into complete nihilism, because I think the human tendency is always to reproduce, recreate sacredness, meaning, even in the face of meaninglessness.
Yeah, and that's an important book, too, that you talk about the time element of all this stuff, is that we do kind of create meaninglessness. And I think back, too. I'm now in into my 50s, and so I, you know, can think back with some historical perspective that every decade I've lived in, I've heard people saying, oh, we're losing meaning, you know, the meaning is lost, the meaning is lost. And it would seem that we've already made it down to zero, or at least that we're asymptotically hitting zero, very close to it. You know, but yet we do recreate this kind of stuff. And, you know, it might not be the meaning I like. You know, I like my 1970s, but, you know, these kids today, I don't know. But, I mean, that's a just a really fascinating observation that you make. And that kind of, again, brings out some of the community stuff. But you have this other chapter, and this gets to chapter 4, the question of, is purpose within you? And your thought initially in this book, and you admit this, that you thought, well, meaning was all going to be cultural. That it's just, you know, you go to church and they tell you, here's your meaning. You memorize it. You go to Denny's after church and then there's your meaning. It's all handed to you on a blue plate special. But it turns out that we have a lot of agency, and you talk about imaginative agency and self-enchantment. Explain that.
Sure. I mean, I think this kind of comes from maybe an initial premise in the book, and that is that we're and this is a Christian Smith's phrase, we're moral believing animals. In other words, we can never get away from interpreting things in moral terms. And that is true of the self, is that we're always struggling to feel good about the self. So that's really my methodological individualism beginning the book, is that we're all together, universally, every individual wants to feel good about themselves. And that requires moral systems of meaning. Now, Weber made a big deal out of the disenchantment of the world, this idea that, you know, we're becoming more secular, we're losing kind of old systems of meaning and becoming more rational. And what that does is it destroys magic and mystery, and so the world becomes disenchanted and all becomes highly rational, and it's very boring and bureaucratic. And I think there's a lot to be said for his critique. However, I make the argument that, well, we're enchantment, maybe the world becomes disenchanted, but one of the things that has happened historically in my mind is that we re-enchant the self. In other words, maybe we're not about exploring the mysterious nature around us, but rather now we're exploring the mysterious nature of ourselves. And so the language of psychology and the kind of the therapeutic culture that comes about with modernity gives us a new type of enchantment, and that is we can start to plumb the mysterious depths of ourselves in psychoanalysis now, you know, and it's endless, right? You can keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And to me, what you ultimately are trying to find is self-enchantment, and that is the belief that yourself is ultimately and immutably good. You found this finally a good self. And now the mystery has been solved and the world has become re-enchanted because you are good and you're doing good in the world and it must feel really good.
You, again, you bring some data to this too. And you're bringing data to a topic or a concept that might be difficult to measure, as we noted before. And you find some correlates to these ways that we think about ourselves as being enchanted. You call them descriptors. Tell us a little bit about what you found there.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, you know, psychologists make a big deal out of, you know, how you self-describe, and that is supposedly an indication of your, you know, personality, which again is this kind of concept that you have some sort of basic self, that if you find it, you can find your personality. And what I was just looking at there is that, well, actually, people describe themselves, they tend to be in very good terms, right? It's very positive terms. And so there is, it to me gives evidence of this deep interest to finding something good about yourself. Am I humble? Oh yes, I'm very humble. You know, that in and of itself is a kind of a puzzler. You know, how can you admit to being humble if you're really humble? But this idea that, these descriptors are saying something deep about yourself, I kind of question in that chapter. And I say really what this is just, your people's attempt to present themselves in the best possible light. Very similar to, you know, people's Facebook pages or something like this, is that this constant tendency to wanting to project a certain sense of self, which in turn is an attempt to convince yourself that it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were all the best drivers on the freeway.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing you mentioned about Facebook. It's like, we're just in this discussion, everybody's saying, yeah, these people on the freeway, none of them are really good at driving, but nobody ever admits that they're bad when driving, so they must be hidden somewhere. But yeah, it's really interesting how we do that. And I guess that's part of the whole process of self-enchantment. We're kind of engaged in this process.
Well, and then kind of from there, I'm saying that self-enchantment is possible. You know, mm-hmm. that you can, there are people who feel really good about themselves. I mean, we might measure that in terms of self-esteem or self-worth, and feel very confident about their beliefs. But that to me doesn't have to do with their supposed innate personality, but really the social context in which they live. And so, you know, I kind of finished the book and said, well, some people are deprived of healthy social context, so they aren't given the tools that they need to feel good about themselves, to be able to self-enchant.
We'll get to that in a second here when we talk about that. But one of the things that comes from self-enchantment, and this leads to your next chapter on is your purpose true with a capital T, is the degrees of certitude that we hold our own purposeful image, so to speak. And that was a really interesting chapter that cuts back to some of your earlier work on religion with the stuff you've done with Chris Bader. So tell us about the search for truth, capital T, and the kinds of truth.
Yeah. So the self-enchantment chapter kind of bleeds into the truth chapter. And what there I was trying to argue is that self-enchantment is dependent on social context, and the best social context to provide you with a very kind of confident sense of self is a social context where people around you, your community, starts to say, look, we know the absolute truth about moral questions. And so this is true of especially very strict religious communities. They say, look, we've got the answer, and no one else has the answer, and we have the answer, and we know what's really, really true. And if you're embedded in those kinds of communities, that's a really good way to start to feel good about yourself, assuming, of course, you're kind of in line with what, you know, the strictures or the rules of that community are. So here I was kind of playing with this idea that a lot of communities, a lot of cultures have this larger sense of transcendent truth that's not dependent on scientific findings or understanding what the current events are. It's really a deeper truth that makes observation in some ways irrelevant. And a good example of that, I don't talk about this in the book, but I think a good example of that is the, you know, the popularity of Donald Trump today. You know, the New York Times is apoplectic because they're like, well, this guy's lying all the time. He never tells the truth. But then you talk to his supporters and they're like, well, no. He is saying something that's deeper, right? There's a truth underneath all of that rhetoric. And that truth is what I'm attached to. We both kind of have the similar values, which are really getting at something universal and deeper. And so the fact that he might, you know, stretch the evidence on this or say something different here is irrelevant because there's this deeper truth that I'm attached to.
And that was a really good part of the book to be reading now. I just read your book about a week ago, and we're in the middle of a campaign season here in mid-September. And you wrote this book, well, it was published about a year ago, I think last fall or last winter, and you must have been writing it before then, so before all this stuff came up. And I'm reading this, I go, oh yeah, one could easily read this into the current political landscape. And as being a political scientist, you know, all my students come to me and they say, oh, Professor Gill, we want to talk about the issues during this campaign. Let's talk about the issues. I'm reading your book and it's basically saying, you know, we're not really talking about the issues when we talk about the issues, because the issues are, I think you even say this in your book, are really boring, right? They're really nitty gritty policy things that maybe only a few academics could really get worked up about. But it's not only true about this campaign, but every campaign. It's that when you talk about the issues, it's really this interesting search about deeper meaning. What is my position in the political landscape and stuff? And so, yeah.
Well, the thing is, it's like, and you know this quite well, it's like the issues are unbelievably complex, right? Like, you're a political scientist, I'm a sociologist, we spend all day like digging into the complexity of this stuff, whereas in the media, and if you're a politician, what are you doing? You're simplifying everything. And so, you know, they're working to the other end. And so clearly because the public, they don't have the time, probably, and also the will to start to delve as in depth as us academics. So it does make sense to me that it isn't really about issues. It's all about these kind of feelings.
Yeah.
How does somebody make you feel?
Even academics don't have the time about it. I know I just get a kick out of this time of year when people say, well, we really need to talk about the issues. And my favorite thing to do with students or other faculty members that get into it, I say, well, let's go talk about the issues. And I point them down to the Federal Register, which is a collection of all the laws and regulations our government creates on a weekly basis. And I say, just go and pull out a random copy and read it, and it's like really boring. You know, the Christmas tree aid promotion agency was going to implement a 15 cent per tree fine. I actually found that one, which was, you know, like, and so it is kind of, but politics is really this interesting discussion about meaning and creation of meaning. And when you start to look at the election and campaigning and democracy writ large in terms of that, it's a conversation about our meaning. And a lot of this, the way you view the world, it changes a little bit, the way you view this stuff.
Well, and this, I think this ties in also to the chapter on time, because the truth chapter is really about being attached to communities that think they have a kind of a lock on truth. So that could be a religious community, it could be a political community. But then you also have, not only is this stuff very complicated, but you don't have any time to really dig too deep in this stuff. And so my chapter on time, I was really curious about, well, gosh, you know, I can talk to religious people and I can talk to political ideologues, and they have like these really strong opinions about what their purpose in life is, what the purpose of the country should be. But you talk to most modern professionals and they're just like, hey man, I don't got the time. And what that tells me is we also have this kind of cultural influence of increasing busyness. And in being busy, people might think, well, you know, I don't really ponder philosophical or religious questions. I don't think about this stuff. But implicitly in buying into the busyness, in being busy yourself, you're leading a purpose in life that's kind of been imposed on you by the larger culture. And it's the purpose really is just getting to the next task without ever questioning why you're doing these tasks to begin with. And so that was, I'm grappling with that issue in the time chapter.
And you write it in an interesting way. I think, again, you have these little colloquiums that are just so fun. You have this little story about a pig. Somebody says, well, what's the pig's meaning of life? And it's like the pig doesn't care because the pig has no concept of time. The pig just wants to be a pig, right? But, yeah. But human beings, we do. And we have these, I guess, cross-cutting times. You talk about the rhythms of life, and as I get older, I kind of look backwards and I see those rhythms of life going up and down, you know, kind of when you're a teenager, you're a young professional, then you're a parent, and then now you're going to become an empty nester. I kind of get those vibes. But then also you talk about cultural tempos, and these things run alongside the rhythms of life. Tell us what cultural tempos are and rhythms of life and how this all affects how we view our meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I like your description of rhythms of life was right on, is that you kind of have these different phases in life where the rhythm is different and also your focus is different. But cultural tempos are kind of, to me, these much more macro. They're less about a stage of life or kind of one's individual situation and more about the culture in general. And in the United States today, for me, the cultural tempo is high, high speed. More, 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 quick, 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 do, 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 is the message that we're all getting constantly. And that, on some level, happens at every stage of life, right? Like kids are scheduled to the hilt.
Yeah.
And then you become a professional, and you can never, ever produce enough because there always has to be more, more, more. And what I find is, or what I'm trying to argue here is that it's very difficult to get cultural tempos and rhythms in life all in sync so that you just feel like you're living at a very nice pace. And that has to do with modernity and with this kind of speeding up constantly of cultural tempos. And the disadvantage, I think, is it makes us all feel very overwhelmed. That we're not keeping pace with things. And especially as people age, they're going to feel more and more out of pace, and it's going to make them feel more and more isolated in a society that's all focused on pace. And so there's a kind of being overwhelmed. Maybe a possible positive side effect is that maybe you're never given time to think about everything. So maybe those darker moments of like, what does this all mean? I'm kind of in despair, come less often because you just don't have that moment to sit back and ponder it.
Well, let me toss something at you. And this is kind of a little bit of a curveball outside of your chapter. Cause as I'm reading that, and I said, the time chapter is really interesting. Cause again, I'm, coming up on empty nester. I can see, retirement. It's not close, but you can see the light at the end of the tunnel for me. And, In what you were saying is that how everything becomes so fast-paced and cultural. Now, I grew up in a time where marriage and family was still a big deal in the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. And recently, literally in the past 4 or 5 years or so, we see this kind of redefinition of marriage, redefinition of relationships. And maybe it's just me as the grumpy old guy saying, kids, get off my lawn, where you young kids with all your hipster beards and stuff. But it is disorienting. And I do think, You mentioned that, we might not have that time to see the dark side of it or get confused by it. But actually, I think we do. And I really do feel out of sync with the common culture. And it affects your purpose in life. And as you start thinking, well, what is my son, who's now going to be moving into his professional career, what's his life going to look like? Mine, is he going to have the same purpose that I did and that kind of thing? And the rise, and you've written about this before and talked about this with Chris Bader and others, the rise of the nuns, the mm-hmm. non-religious folks, people getting married later, people not going to church as much, or a lot of different things that have been happening in the last decade. How does this all play in the search of meaning? Are we all more confused now? I'm starting to feel Weber's nihilism all come seeping in again.
Yeah, I am too, as you're speaking.
Yeah, because you're not that much younger than I am. You're kind of closing up on me.
Well, so. The thing is, you know, I personally felt this crazy, like, paradox of moving from having lots of potential to immediately being, like, obsolete, right? Like, without that sweet spot of, like, being in the moment of, you know, now I'm living up to my potential, right? Like, you move from having potential to being obsolete without any transition. And that, to me, has to do with the pace of things, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is going so quickly. And I guess I do agree that one of the problems of having the tempo of culture quickening is that meanings start to change so rapidly that you have no foundation for anything anymore. And so maybe that really is the source of nihilism, the source of meaninglessness, in a kind of a Peter Berger sense, right? This crisis of credibility. I don't know what to believe anymore because everything's changing so quickly. So I think there's something very valid to that. And I do think it's related to the quickening tempos, meaning changing so dramatically. And it will be very interesting to kind of watch our children and see what kind of world are they going to live in. How are they going to find employment? How are they going to find meaning? Is it going to be different than us?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Peter Berger because you bring up that sacred canopy thing. I think you're resurrecting that for Peter Berger. I think Berger jettisoned it for a while, and you might be the one who's resurrecting the whole sacred canopy idea again in terms of, we're finding the idea of God is being contested. That's one of the arguments that you talk about in one of the last chapters of your book, that, finding what is God really mean? What is all this out here? And being confused as time speeds up on us and such. But yet, as you talked about at the earlier in the interview here, that, you found out that we do create meaning throughout history.
Yeah.
So there's a sense to be pessimistic, but there's also a sense to be optimistic.
Well, and maybe I wanted the book to be very positive, right? I mean, it'd be easier to write a very dark book about this topic. But I want it to be kind of positive, kind of uplifting, although there's some kind of depressing parts to it also. And part of that, where I end the book is this idea of like, well, meaning is always being recreated so that you can never kill it off. You can never kill off having a purpose to life, because humans by their nature are just going to reinvent it somehow. So I think that's kind of a positive ending, and that it gives us pause to say, well, it looks from my perspective like everything is just going to hell, but you know what? People will figure a way. And I think what gives me indication of that is you look at very dark times in human history. When people, let's say, obviously this is happening now around the world, but eras or times when people have been living under totalitarianism or some terrible, just tragic government has taken over. People find meaning. They find each other. They still have positive outlooks, and you can find this in the literature and the writing and the relationships that still exist, even in the bleakest of times. And so that is always a kind of a reason to hope. Even if things go really crappy and our cultural tempo gets completely out of control, we'll still find a way to find a meaning of life.
Yeah, as you bring up the totalitarian governments, the times that were really crappy. I mean, everybody says we live in crappy times, but if you look back in history, there's some really, really crappy times.
Yeah.
And you actually had a chance to, early in your career, write about one of them, is the Soviet era. And I can just now see, looking backwards on your intellectual trajectory, where you are from On Purpose to where you are with your book on Killing God in the Soviet Union. There's a trajectory there. That's kind of interesting. And I want to finish off with this question I always love to ask my guests, is that, you've been at this for some time now, and you've been thinking about this book On Purpose for a couple years in specific. Is there anything that you've learned or you changed your mind or that surprised you over the course of writing this book or from the times when you were a wee graduate student at the University of Washington that, you know, you're a different person now. What's happening there?
You know what's interesting? I like this question of yours. And just kind of thinking about it, I realized that I might have actually returned to something very early on in my intellectual development. And I think you've noticed in reading this book, there's a lot of Russian literature cited. And so as a college student, I was a Russian literature major. And so that was kind of my first love, my first, you know, kind of participation in intellectual life. And one of my favorite writers is Dostoevsky. And if you remember in Notes from Underground, he makes this argument about, like, you social scientists think you can predict the human. And he's like, nah, you're wrong. And the reason is that as a human, I can always invent something new and always kind of sneak up on you and do something that's unexpected. And then, of course, later in my life, I got into social science. I became a sociologist, which is all about trying to predict behavior, right? It's, you know, using data and theory and saying, all right, see the human, we can kind of predict. We know what they're going to do. They're actually really predictable. And so for me, maybe this book was an attempt to combine the two in saying, look, the purpose of life is something that's very deep and very abstract, but it's kind of predictable. You can predict it based on your historical circumstance, the community you're in, your kind of family. These things all really dictate who you are. But then at the end of the book, I kind of come back and say, well, you know what? Maybe Dostoevsky has a point. Maybe at the end of the day, our imagination can always kind of twist things a little bit, make things a little bit different. And so maybe that's what I came out of this book with, is that Dostoevsky's right. Maybe there is free will. We can imagine different things, and we can be unpredictable if we want.
Well, that just might be the meaning of life here, that it's predictable. We're searching for predictability, but it's unpredictable, but it's predictably unpredictable. So
there you go. Maybe, I love that. It's predictably unpredictable.
Maybe that's the answer to the meaning of life. My guest today has been Paul Froese. Paul, thanks for coming back on Research on Religion.
Hey, Tony, thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.